Hey, Zero Block 30 listeners, you can find us every Tuesday and Friday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. Prime members can also listen ad-free on Amazon Music.
What if the golf ball you're playing isn't the number one ball for you? Meet the all-new TP5 and TP5X from TaylorMade. Whether you prefer the softest five-layer tour ball in the TP5 or the fastest, that's now a half a club longer in TP5X, you'll be playing a golf ball that performs like it was built just for you. Available in white, yellow, and picks, you can personalize it with my symbol. No matter which you choose, every TP5, TP5X is designed to help your game. Head to TaylorMadeGolf.com today to find the number one ball for you.
Yeah, we've never had anybody twice, and this time we're even more happy to have author too to add to the title of Navy SEAL and things like that. But you're also an author now. Rob O'Neill, welcome back to Zero Block 30,
my
friend.
Thank you for having me. That's nice. I'm the first recurring, which means you guys like me, so that makes me feel nice.
Yeah, and what's great is that you were on very early with our show, only our fourth episode, and I think we've gained a few followers and listeners here and there, so it's going to be a real treat for anybody who's new to the show to listen to what you have to say.
Well, good. That's good stuff.
Well, you've been on a busy time. I mean, your book came out, I think, two weeks ago, right?
A week ago, yes, it came out.
And so you've been touring all over the place, telling everybody, and we are interviewing you today on Tuesday, March 2nd.
May 2nd.
Which is a pretty... May. Yeah, May. So it's a pretty... Sorry, I had stupid brain. All right, so it's a pretty big day, and not only the history of America, but the history of your life for sure, as the anniversary of the death of one Osama bin Laden, which you had a little bit to do with, right?
Yeah, I did. It was it's an interesting anniversary because it was May 2nd local time there, and it was sort of May 1st, well, exactly May 1st here, so it's kind of a dual date. But yeah, 6 years ago, we were just... right about now getting back, and it was quite a night because that was supposed to be most of our last night on the planet because we were pretty sure something bad was going to happen. Had the potential to happen. You know, we could get shot down by something on the flight into his house in Pakistan, or, you know, if anyone's going to have a house-borne improvised explosive device, it would be him. Anything from running out of fuel, losing a helicopter. It was a mission where we accepted death. And it wasn't on the front of our minds, but we knew it was a high chances that we weren't going to make it back.
I mean, more so than any other mission, because obviously, you know, just the nature of your unit that you were with, pretty much every mission is pretty dangerous. So, but this was at the top of the list in terms of...
That was the top of the list as far as potential danger going into it. I've had scarier times there when I was working, but that was just because something went wrong. You know, find yourself on the low ground in Afghanistan, and then all of a sudden you're overwhelmed and trying to get air support, but trying to keep your head down at the same time. But this one, going into it, we had a couple of weeks to think about the possibilities being very, very high, even to the point where I remember having a last meal with my kids, even though I couldn't tell them where I was headed. Very emotional time, but what was cool about it, just because that was there, and that's what I talk about in my new book, The Operator, is... You're able to see how people respond to each other when we're all going out on the same mission. We're all accepting this possible end result, but we're going to do it. And, you know, we're here. This is why we came. This is, you know, everybody joins for a reason. We were given this opportunity, and I would rather go on a mission like this and get killed than not go on the mission and live the rest of my life wishing I did.
Was there any... I mean, I'm sure that you had excitement and fear and all that, but was there a point during the training where you started to dread it? Like, where you thought that maybe this might be the paramount moment of my life and what comes after this point?
No, the only bit of potential regret was if they told us, no, we're just going to bomb the place, because it's all that build up for nothing. I did regret that they made us fast rope so much because, you know, we're starting to get really bad tendonitis. We were just continually proving. This is during the training for the Bin Laden mission. We're continually training just to prove to people up the chain of command that we can do it. And now it's like, hey, my arms are killing me. I can barely hold the gun. I promise you, as a Navy SEAL, I can fast rope. Everyone knows how to fast rope. Let's know. But other than that, it was just an incredible experience. Just what we saw, what we did, and how our minds came together. And I mean, even to the we trained for the we had the perfect plan, trained on the perfect plan so many times, and then nothing happened the way it was supposed to. Everything went wrong.
I feel like that's just the way it goes sometimes. And I mean, how long did you train prior to?
When we were told about the mission, we probably had 2 weeks of gear prep and then, I'm sorry, 2 days of gear prep and then 2 weeks of training in two different areas. And what that happened is they built up a training site that looked like the compound, the exterior of the compound, just so the pilots could get used to the what kind of angles to come in, what kind of an approach. We could get used to our fast rope points, where we're going to drop guys off on the land and how we're going to get onto the rooftop and things like that. So it was a good time. It's funny in retrospect too that the only guy who fast roped was the flight lead, the pilot. That's the way he got out of the helicopter that crashed. Everyone else just got out. It's kind of crazy.
So does that make you laugh that you did all this training and then nothing went to plan?
You know, it's like you're saying though. It was just typical. That's the way it seems that a lot of things in life go. One of my favorite sayings is life is what happens around you while you're making the perfect plan. Everything else is what's actually going to happen. So, it's just proof. I don't mean to make light of it. It's been 6 years, and the pilot that crashed definitely saved everyone's lives on that helicopter. It wasn't just SEALs that went, and these were Army pilots and the best in the world as far as I'm concerned. And just to make that life and death that decision, when your initial reaction would be to power – he was telling me, I'm not a pilot, but he was telling me that is to power up, and that would have rolled it because of the Areolas effect going on, the updraft. He would have killed everybody, but he made the decision to crash land. And then he actually said he could probably fly it out if we want to get a shot at it. We eventually blew the helicopter up.
Wow. So if I remember correctly from your last time on, you said that SEAL Team 6 wasn't even in Afghanistan. You're in a different theater, and you guys got selected to move. Isn't that correct?
Well, the team this book that I wrote is the first one about an operator on the ground on the Bin Laden raid and like the Phillips raid that's actually approved by the Pentagon. I'm getting to a point here, I promise. But the Pentagon did approve this. The departments approved this book. One of the words they redacted is the SEAL team that I was on, so I'm not allowed to say it. But okay. That SEAL team, we had just finished a troop in Afghanistan. We were back in the United States, and I was in South Beach on a dive trip, which is kind of a good deal after combat. And they recalled us up to Virginia to sit us down. Like they took our squadron, took about a little more than half of the squadron in a room, didn't let the rest of the guys in, and they started to tell us stuff that was sort of nonsense. Like they came up with some thing. They wanted us together. They wanted to get us to a training site before they told us. So they didn't tell us for a few days what it was until we got down to the training site a little bit south of Virginia. And then once we were there, they did tell us what we were doing. But, yeah, we were just back from deployment, which you would think you get some time to, recock and get to be with your families. But that was the reason they sent us, because no one would really notice if we were traveling. We have teams that are doing certain stuff here and there, but if they leave all of a sudden, people are going to notice. And if the team's already deployed, stop doing missions to train, someone's going to notice. So no one would notice if we were going to start going places and training. It wouldn't raise any eyebrows. I mean, because basically there's a lot of units we all know that could have done that one. We just had the right people in the right places, and it was the right timing for my team and I to get on it. But it was definitely way out of the norm.
I mean, but you guys had to have an idea that this was going to be something pretty big, that you got recalled pretty quickly after getting back from a deployment.
Yeah, at first you want to think of the training exercise, but once you get into a room and they kick people out that should be there, and they start the first words out of their mouth, this is for real. And then they start lying to you about what you're doing. You're trying to put two and two together. And we were actually this is obviously 2011, so we were thinking about the awakening over in North Africa and parts that started in Tunisia, moved into Egypt and Libya. We were thinking that they found Muammar Gaddafi, and that's what we were going to do. Because we asked them, where is it? Well, we can't tell you. Okay, how are we getting there? Can't tell you. And they wouldn't tell us anything. So we were assuming maybe it was a flat-top Navy ship with some of the Ospreys on there, and they just didn't want to tell us we were using those because they've had a checkered past, but they're getting better now, and more guys are inserting on them. So we're trying to add it all up. Why would it be a – because I remember somebody asked them, what are the aircraft, and they said they're like helicopters. So that just seemed a natural thing that they were Ospreys. So we were thinking about, and then it turned into people that started coming into the briefs once we got to our training site. They were from certain parts of certain agencies that dealt with Pakistan, and then we're like, well, that's it. I mean, there's no doubt it's Bin Laden. Mm-hmm. And then they did tell us it's Bin Laden.
And you've done some other big high profile missions like rescuing Captain Phillips. Was Captain Phillips raid kind of the same thing, or were they really hush-hush about it?
That was similar because we were in Virginia Beach again, and it was actually a Good Friday, April 10th, which is my birthday. And I was at my daughter's – she had a tea party for Easter at her preschool, and I was there with that. And we're like feeding the kids treats and whatnot and getting them tea, and all of a sudden we got a message that we recognized the code. And Captain Richard Phillips was taken by Somali pirates. So that was pretty much the same team. I think most of the guys on the Bin Laden raid were on the Phillips raid too. So I went from kissing my daughter on the forehead to being in the Indian Ocean 16 hours later, less than 16 hours later, with a full head count and four boats. And we rescued Richard Phillips, you know, on Easter. So we left on Friday, and we had him rescued by Sunday. So that was another one where we left from Virginia Beach. That one wasn't as unusual as a Bin Laden raid, though, because we were, again, lucky in the position that if something, we call it a national mission, came up, which is that one, then the team that's there in Virginia can take off and be anywhere in the world.
Can you say who some of the high-level players are that were doing the approval or no?
Did approve the book?
That approved the Bin Laden raid, that they went on to watch you guys train, and they were giving the thumbs up or thumbs
down. They sent in the highest ranking person that came to one of the training sites was Admiral Mike Mullen, who was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at the time. So the highest ranking officer in the military. And then he was just reporting back because there's a lot of other stuff going on. And he would go back and brief the Joint Chiefs and the obviously administration, the president. And there were other Pentagon officials there too. I guess at the time they called it Special Operations Low Intensity Conflict, so SOLIC, civilian side, but really smart dudes. So high-end special operations civilian guys, and then the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and they had the ear of the president.
And then
was that common for you to have to prove that you could do it to a high-level officer?
No. That they were pretty good at using delegation and reverse delegation to trusting the people below them. So it was very – by the time Mullen showed up and we knew we were going after Bin Laden, so it wasn't a surprise. But when they initially told us at the first brief we might have, like, the vice president and the secretary of the Navy there, that really surprised us. That's when the wheels started spinning about something big. But, when we were out of the final training area, it's one of those things, like, we don't want to – repeat Desert One, which is the botched rescue in Iran in 1979 or 80. I forget the date. But they wanted to make sure they saw the guys, had a nice warm and fuzzy. And that just got us in, like, the top three options to get Bin Laden, one of which was a major bombing, one was a small bombing, and then us, and they ended up picking us.
And then, you know, in the movie Zero Dark Thirty, we see that the CIA was heavily involved. How much were how accurate is that they were heavily involved in your training, and were they there as somewhat of a subject matter expert about the compound?
Yes, we had the movie Zero Dark Thirty is based about the famous woman analyst, the female analyst who found him, and she was with us every step of the way up to the point that we launched out of Jalalabad to cross the border. She was there for all of it. She's because we obviously had a lot of questions for her, and she wanted to see how we were doing, because she and her team, she had a team that found him, had been working that forever. And I'm assuming Zero Dark Thirty was pretty accurate, because I think the director helped consult on the damn thing. So I thought it was a pretty good movie, and the woman who found him, she was portrayed great in the movie, and that's kind of what she was like. And they had representatives there the whole time. The agency had built up all of our training areas and the super stuff that was ready for us when we got there. So that was their thing. They found them.
Well, let's fast forward to you're getting on the bird, getting ready to go actually conduct the mission. Kind of walk us through from that point.
Well, we had quite a few SEALs there, and we'd all been to war before, and this one was just a little different when we're saying goodbye to each other, because instead of like the normal, hey, man, have a good fight, go crush them, we're just giving everybody hugs because this could be it for us, and we all knew it. wasn't sad. It was just, it was kind of awesome. And then we took the bus out to the helicopters, got on the birds and took off. And normally we left from Jalalabad airfield, and normally the flight up, like if you go north from Jalalabad, you're going to take a left at the mountains and then go to Asadabad and then maybe into the Pesh River Valley or the Korangal or something like that. This time we just turned right, and it was very cool to hear the pilots announce when we were in Pakistani airspace. So then you're like, all right, we can start counting down. We got 90 minutes to get there. And just kind of looking around at the guys, the very serious professionals, and you know, just guys doing what they do on flights, you know, trying to figure out a way to use try to pee and try to sleep and use their iPods and all that stuff. And it was neat to see the level we were flying, how cool the pilots were, because they were really crushed at flying low, really, really fast, and just maneuvering around the obstacles that potentially could have been there, the terrain features. And I was just, you know, sitting there, I was sitting on one of those tripod chairs that you get, you know, from a hunting store or whatever, and the dog Cairo was right next to my my left foot. And just kind of going through what we're going to do. We'd done it so many times, we knew it was going on. And then the further you get into it, it's sort of calming because, okay, we haven't been shot yet. They probably don't know. Then we were 45 minutes into it, and that's when our the second helicopters, we had two more come in. And that was just with some quick reaction force guys that we had, because they were really serious. If we're going to get sort of compromised on the ground, we're going to send in more SEALs and Rangers because we're going to figure out what's in this compound, but we're going to try to be quiet at first. So we heard them cross, and that's when you start worrying a little more, because they didn't have the technology on their helicopters that we did, but still had some that were able to defeat some radar and stuff. Nothing happened there. And then about 80 minutes in, we turned to the right, and it was a neat moment for me too. I keep using that word because that's all I can think. I can think of neat and proud, because I'm just so proud of my guys and proud of the pilots. And when we turned to the south to make our attack run, I remember George Bush's words, President Bush, on 9/11, when he said, "Freedom itself was attacked this morning by a faceless coward, and freedom will be defended." And that's when it kind of started to sink in. It's like, okay, this is it. We're really going to do it. And I just started saying that over and over in my head. We made another turn, and we opened the doors at 2 minutes out, and there's like electricity. And I remember on the map a golf course, and it's like, wow, we're invading a sovereign nation here. This is not Afghanistan. This is like real stuff. And we started going into the compound. I was in the second helicopter, Dash 1. The first one was going to go to its fast rope point between the main house and the guest house and let all their guys out and leave. And then we were going to put our snipers down on the north side of the wall and then put our team on the rooftop. And as soon as we went into land, we let the snipers, the dog, and the interpreter out, and the pilot started to take off, and he instantly went back down to the ground. So we didn't know why he did that, but he saw the other helicopter go down, but we didn't. But he was knowing, like, if they can't hover, then I can't hover. So he just put us down there, and he took off. We got out of the helicopter, and instantly it looked exactly like the house that we'd been training on. Very cool. We knew the external dimensions. Looked at the as we're facing the house, from the north off to our left is the northeast side. There was a door or a big gate that we knew we could blow there and get in from the corner. We walked over to the gate, and our breacher put a big charge of a breaching charge. I think it was a 7-footer, a C6. He blasted the door really quickly, and it opened, but there was a brick wall behind it, like a fake door. So he instantly said, you know, failed breach. He said, this is bad. And I remember thinking, no, this is good, because that's a fake. Someone important is in there. He's in there. And then we said some stuff about we didn't know where the second helicopter was. We heard him say we thought it was Dash 1 going around, but they said Dash 1 going down. But we thought they went around, so we came over the radio and said we're going to blow the carport. Now, that's further to our right, right by the main house. And they said, no, don't blow it. We'll just open it. And so they opened it, and a thumb came out. And that's one of the points where, okay, I don't know how they got in there, but I don't want to waste time to ask. They're in there. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about it later. And then other guys were already engaged in a couple gunfights right then when I walked through the main carport. And then I was looking off to my left, and there's Bin Laden's house. And I remember thinking, I know we're probably going to blow up and die tonight, but I'm going to take this in. This is historic. So I'm walking up there looking at Bin Laden's house. Came around a corner. There were guys that were looking through windows. And already some guys inside the main door, which is on the south side of the main house. And then I walked in, and some guys let me know that a helicopter crashed. It was theirs, which is crazy. And then the thoughts were just, well, you know, we're in this to win it. I mean, we might not have enough to get everyone out of here, but let's might as well find them. And then this is the point, too, where I'm in a position where I'm about eight guys back, so I'm looking down a hallway with a bunch of operators in front of me, and I'm just thinking how cool it is that they're doing this, how awesome that we know the risk, but they're just doing their job. They're breaching the doors. They're doing mechanical breaching, some minor explosive breaching, and everyone's doing, you know, rounding people up, putting them in different rooms together. And then we started going up the stairs once they got the door at the end of the hallway open. And the female analyst had told us that she doesn't know the layout of the house, but there will be a stairwell. And on the stairwell, you're going to run into Khalid Bin Laden. And she was 100% right. I don't know how you know that from just looking overhead, but she did. So I was still far back, far enough back that I couldn't do anything about it, but I could watch, and I wanted to watch. I wanted to see what happened, and I get into the book how the guy in front of our stack or line took care of Khalid Bin Laden. It's an incredible part where when he eliminated Khalid, I remember thinking, man, I hope we live through tonight because people need to know what happened. That was so smart and amazing. And so we climbed up the stairs. The stairs kind of were up, you know, back and forth stairs, not quite circular, but kind of like that. And we got to the second floor, and about six or seven of the guys in front of me, between me and the lead guy, the point man, split off to the left and right to clear the other areas. We didn't know there's more hallways and more rooms and stuff like that. And then that left just the point man and myself looking up a set of stairs at a curtain. And then the point man started to let me know that, you know, this is, we got to get going. He didn't know it was me, but he knew it was one of his guys. And he's like, we got to get going up these stairs because they're behind he knew that behind that curtain on top of the stairs, they were putting on vests, suicide vests, explosives. He could see people moving. So at that point, I knew I gave him a squeeze, but it wasn't out of bravery. It was more of, I'm tired of thinking about this. Let's just get it over with. I squeezed him. We went up the stairs. He opened the curtain, and then he jumped on.
And a squeeze, I'm sorry to interrupt, but a squeeze lets you know, like, if you're doing tactical things, yeah. Like if you're an operator, it means go. Like, you're not talking. Yeah. It's just completely nonverbal communication.
That is correct. So a squeeze on the shoulder or the back of the thigh, just to let him know. And that's just the two-man telling the one-man, we're set. We have enough guys. Even though we didn't have enough guys. We had two, but he didn't need to know that.
Yeah.
So we went up, he opened the curtain and jumped on some people that he assumed were wearing vests. So I watched him, I watched the guy jump on a grenade that didn't go off. Like, he gave his life for the guy behind him so he could absorb the blast and maybe the guy behind him get a shot off. Because we're pretty sure Bin Laden was in the room to the right. So he did that, and then I turned to the right, and sure enough, 3 feet away, standing up with his hands on his wife's shoulders was Osama Bin Laden. I saw him for a less than a second, did a quick target identification with, you know, he's 6'3", skinnier than I thought. His beard is shorter. It's gray, but that's him. I recognize his nose. We've seen the face 1,000 times. I assumed he was, because he was not surrendering. He was not surrendering, I guess, the way you put it. So he's a threat. I'm assuming he's got a suicide vest on. So I did what you do to suicide bombers. I shot him in the face twice. He fell down. I shot him again, and it was pretty much over before I even realized what was happening. His wife was still there, so I put her on the bed and then sort of gave her a quick search. And his two-year-old son was standing there too, and I remember as a father just thinking, you know, this sucks that this poor kid has nothing at all to do with this. So I picked him up, put him next to his mom. Other SEALs were coming in the room, and then that's when it started to sink in. I actually had a guy come up to me and say, are you all right? And I said, yeah, what do we do now? And he laughed at me. He goes, well, now we go find the computers, man. You've done this 1,000 times. And I was like, yeah, you're right. I'm back. And he goes, holy shit, you just killed Osama Bin Laden. And I'm like, yeah. He's like, your life just changed. So that was that. And then we searched for whatever we could find, electronic computers and hard drives and disks and stuff like that. when I went back upstairs, we went downstairs to do that. Went back upstairs. They'd already put Bin Laden in the body bag. I helped carry the body bag outside. We brought him out to the front, and then we started to extract, just let people know, hey, we got another bird coming in, a Chinook. We're going to put the first team on the one we came in on. The second team gets on the Chinook. We had one of our breachers and our explosive ordnance guy rig the other bird. They blew that up, and then we got on a helicopter, and we took off. And we were on the ground for about, I want to say, 34 minutes. Really, really quick, and then helicopter landed, and we got on, and then we turned around and started going back to Afghanistan. And that's when it got really really weird, because now we're leaving, and the pilot's flying as fast as he can, and it's 90 minutes back to Pakistan – or, sorry, back out of Pakistan into Afghanistan. And if we live through 90 minutes, we'll probably get another 50 years of life. So then you're just sitting there in this helicopter flying, and you kind of start the stopwatch, and you're just watching it. But no one's saying anything because you don't want to jinx it, you know, like a no-hitter.
Yep.
So we're flying back in, you know, 10 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes. It's like, wow, we're getting close. And you don't want to think about maybe Pakistan scrambling jets or whatever they're doing in 40 minutes, 50 minutes. And then it turns into one of those things. The best analogy or similarity, I guess, to the emotion was – Miracle when the Americans beat the Russians in Lake Placid in the Olympics, when you can hear the crowd counting down, you know, 10, mm-hmm. 9, 8, and all that stuff. Nervous at first, and then 85 minutes in, we hear the pilot say, all right, gentlemen, for the first time in your lives, you're going to be happy to hear this. Welcome to Afghanistan.
Yeah,
and we're just
that's
like,
crazy.
Wow.
And those,
we did it.
I mean, and those 160th guys, those pilots, I mean, they're really, they are the best in the world, and the technology they have on those birds to keep them so low to the ground. It must have been a good feeling knowing you were in such good hands getting you
home. It was always refreshing. I don't care where you are in the world. If you have the 160th flying for you, you're in great. They can fly through a door and pick you up. They're amazing. Mm-hmm. I love them. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, they don't get enough credit because they risked it all too, and they're just incredible guys.
Now, there's a report that came out this week, and I think it's been around for a little longer than that, actually, that whenever you shot Bin Laden in the head, it canoed him. And there was reports that came out from a so-called special forces reporter that said that Bin Laden's body actually had more than 100 bullet holes in it. Can you address that?
Yeah, that's someone trying to get a name for himself. And the thing, the canoe thing, just I don't know. I read some articles too, and that said that was like a SEAL team calling card, like put him down and then canoe him. And I mean, I've heard guys say before, you know, yeah, he got canoed. But that's like when you shoot someone in the head from 3 feet, I don't care. It's gonna mess them up.
Yeah.
Right. And so, I mean, yeah, his head looked horrible, but no one's going to walk in and purposely shoot, especially someone like that. But I mean, everything from, you know, just having your gear to a point of weight where it's as light as possible and everything is essential. And you might need as many bullets as you can to maybe run out of a country or whatever. No one's going to waste bullets. He, you know, if he was shot a few times, I don't know, but I certainly didn't canoe anybody. It's a waste of time. You know, there's stuff out there too about tomahawks and all that stuff. It's all cool memorabilia, but nobody's carrying that stuff because weight is measured in ounces, and ounces equal pounds, and we're not going to carry non-essential gear just to be a really good gamer, you know?
Yeah, like a folklore type thing.
Yeah, it is too. It'd just be ridiculous. I mean, yeah, if you've seen someone shot in the head for real and not in Hollywood, you know, he doesn't fly through a window and into a pool. His head splits open and he falls on himself. It's that's what happened. And, you know, I hit him 3 times, and that's just...
Would they want you to say what weapon you're using? MP4, MP5?
No, I used an HNK-416.
Okay.
I didn't realize
you. If you guys want to tag H and K in one of these, it wouldn't hurt me to get a little thumbs up from them.
Yeah, I didn't realize you were that close to him. You're only 3 feet away.
Yeah, because the way the stairs went up, the curtain was right there before a hallway, and the hallway's connected right to the bedroom, and he was like right there. I didn't even get to make entry in the room until he was down.
Yeah,
so it was a shot. It was a. I guess it's one of those, you know, basic CQB, don't shoot through the door, but Bin Laden's house, go ahead.
Yeah. And I, you
was
know,
it kind of like when you first saw Bin Laden? Like, I would imagine that it's like kind of like the first time that you have sex, you want it to last a lot longer, like look him in the eye a little bit, but then you, but you just happen to fucking nut like right away.
Yeah. I couldn't believe. Yeah, totally.
Oh, man.
I
hey, Rob, there's an analogy you're not going to hear on Fox News.
Oh, that's so goodness. Funny. Yeah, I couldn't believe how fast it was over, and I can't believe how many people are here.
Hey, but I think it's worth mentioning again, and we don't need to – obviously, we're not going to say his name, but your teammate who jumped on those two individuals,
yeah,
essentially like, I'm going to give my life for this mission, he needs you know, shake his hand for everybody – in the country, because that's amazing.
He's not in it for the medals, but I saw stuff on. We got blanket silver stars, which is incredible, and it's an honor to even be asked to be on that. But someone that jumps on a suicide vest—that's Medal of Honor
Medal
stuff
of honor.
On a big.
Yeah.
As far as I'm concerned, I hope he eventually gets it. They got to know what he did.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's not like there's not going to be enough documentation for you guys, Jesus Christ. It's not like some of the other missions.
I'm pretty sure that's
the most documented mission that we've had.
So, Rob, all right, so we're back in the bird. You're crossing back into Afghanistan. At what point does it sink in what you guys just did?
When we got back there, and, you know, because we crossed in Afghanistan, it's maybe a 10-minute flight, I think, from the border. So we got back to our airfield from where we had taken off, and just watching everybody walk around, it's got to be like I'd imagine the Patriots, when they won the Super Bowl, when they were down by so many in the fourth, it's mm-hmm. like it came back, and well, we were supposed to win, but yes, you know, stuff like that. Just watching them walk, everyone was, it was so cool, so proud, just like, I couldn't believe, I mean, I keep using the same words, but like, my guys were so cool, I was so proud of my team, and it was just, all right, what do we do now? Let's button them up and get them up to Bagram Airfield so the FBI can do their tests on them and the DNA stuff, and let's get the intel to the right people that we found, And it was just, it was really, really, just, it was a great few hours because we, you know, we had just done it. And we, you know, then we start seeing stuff on the internet because we did have access and we hear the president and it's like, okay, they kind of leaked our name and it's this, I don't know if this is going to be good or not. But I mean, it was, for a while, it was the greatest thing ever. I said when I, before.
But
when
that
I,
wasn't instantaneous whenever President Obama made the announcement. I'm sure like it was kind of like. So difficult. You had a long career doing secret squirrel shit where you had to keep stuff after action reports and stuff like that silent for a long time. But killing Osama bin Laden, there had to be those moments where you wanted to call your daughter or your parents or whoever and be like, oh my God, you're not going to believe this shit when you hear it.
Yeah, there was too. And it was, I mean, even with the book that we're talking about here, the bin Laden raid was. I'd already done, most of the guys on my team had already done, you know, 400 direct action combat missions. And so, like, the bin Laden raid is chapter 23. There's so many more in there. This, again, it's been vetted by the Pentagon, vetted by the department, so it's legit. But, like, that was, it just built up to that. It was, like, most of the stuff that, even the most exciting ones that I was on with my squadron, people don't know about.
Yeah,
but,
so, Rob, like tomorrow I go to Barnes & Noble, I pick up the operator. What is a story in there that I'm going to read, you know, as much as you want to share with us here, that I'm going to sit back and think, wow, that's kind of crazy?
Well, there was one we were involved with the rescue of Marcus Luttrell, the lone survivor. For people who don't know, that was when the four snipers went into the Korangal and they got compromised. Big gunfight, a helicopter went in to get him. One was shot down. 20 guys died on that helicopter, and then they sent us in as part of a coalition to try to find whomever might be alive still, be it crash site or snipers. About three years later, I was in Assadabad, Afghanistan, which is right near where all this went down. Our intel people found the guy that fired the – well, I still think it was a missile, but that's, you know, whatever. They say RPG. I don't buy it. On the Pakistan side of the border – and I knew he would stay there safe because that's what they do. But if I could lure him to shoot at us, we could engage. And we could, as long as we had continuous positive identification and troops in contact, I could engage. I could pursue into Pakistan and chase him. I wanted to kill this guy.
Yep.
You know, so I arranged again a perfect plan to how to get to the border, make them see us, and hopefully think we were small and attack. And so that's the only part I got right because it ended up complete shit show. We ended up on the low ground and they surrounded us on a couple different sides and they had so I learned that day that there's nothing worse than having people shoot at you with effective fire and your gun cannot reach them. Ugh. And you got to figure out a way and to get something done. So we got surrounded on three sides daytime about like noonish, and we had nowhere
to
go.
Which is odd
for
you guys to be normally you operate under the cover of darkness.
Yes. But this is one of those moves that was kind of revenge and boredom can get you in a lot of trouble.
Yeah, maybe one of those scenarios where you ask for forgiveness as opposed to permission.
That's exactly what it was. So so we got in a long fight with doing stuff that like you've read about in field manuals but never done, like why you put your non-essentials in a backpack so that if you need to run you can ditch your backpack type stuff.
Sure.
Yeah, so that happened for a while. It took us a full hour to get any air support in, and the guy that I had calling air support, that was his first time ever calling live bombs. So a lot can go wrong. We ended up, I don't want to ruin the story, but we ended up getting a B-1 first, about an hour or so into it, which is nice. And then I authorized bombings there and then into Pakistan. So we bombed Pakistan for about 3 hours maybe. And then the next day, it was one of those stories about an unprovoked attack by coalition forces and killed Pakistani military. What actually was happening is we were fighting Taliban, Al-Qaeda, and Pakistan, which is not surprising because they're all pretty much in that part of the world, they're all together. And I had obviously we had a big investigation, and they had a general investigating it, and he came to see me at where I was in Assadabad, and he said, we have some footage. We're reviewing it now, and we're having a panel. So basically, you're going to go to Leavenworth or get a Silver Star.
Well, so, that's wow. An interesting two choices right there.
Yeah, and I'll tell you what. You think waiting an hour for bombs is a long time? Try waiting 3 weeks to find out the decision.
Oh my God, that had to be agonizing.
Man.
It's terrible. But that's one of the stories in there. That's I didn't ruin any of the story. That's a crazy story. That's probably one of those missions where you thought you were invincible, and now I'm going to die in the daytime on this mountain, and what are they going to do with my body type stuff?
Jesus.
Crazy. Well, Rob, thanks again, man. That was awesome the second time we had you on the show, and I'm sure that there'll be a third down the road. Go get his book, The Operator, anywhere books are sold, and follow him at MC Huya on Twitter and Instagram. Thanks a lot, Rob. We appreciate it, man. This is going to be a pretty politics-free episode, too. I'm going to start giving you guys warning at the beginning of the show.
So you don't turn off.
Yeah, so you don't turn it off. So you're like, fuck these guys, back at it again with the politics talk. There's a little politics involved, but one of the things I wanted to touch on, I wrote the blog today. I just found out about it. A Canadian, mind you. A Canadian broke the world record for the longest sniper shot ever.
How far was it?
2.2 fucking miles, man.
That's pure insanity.
2.2 miles. Connor and I were talking about it before we started recording. The 2.2 miles is so long, man.
Yeah.
So long. Like, imagine you, most of you listening are probably at least in your 20s. Imagine just going to run 2.2 miles at this point in your life.
Right. That's going to take a bit.
Yeah. Honestly, for me, it would probably take me about 20 minutes at this point.
Mm-hmm.
It would take me a while. And it got there in 10 seconds. But imagine, again, how long 10 seconds is, because that's what the military sources said, that the bullet was actually in the air for 10 seconds. And if you've ever spent any time on a firing range like you and I have, 10 seconds is a long time to pull the trigger and expect people to be in the same exact spot, like the same body size spot.
Yeah, no, it's crazy because when you think about like qualifying on a standard range, you're hitting targets anywhere from 5 meters away to 300 meters away. Even when you're hitting those 300 meters.
500 for us, but whatever.
Okay, sorry. Either way, all right, so we'll go 500.
With iron sights.
With iron sights, 500 meters. Even if you're hitting a target 500 meters away, that's hitting pretty almost instantaneously. So, and you pointed out greatly in your blog, how many things have to go right to make that shot? Because, yeah, granted, you have a scope on that rifle, but you have to be extremely still. You have to factor in weather. You have to factor in the rotation of the Earth. I mean, there are...
Yeah, let's pull it back before we go that far. Let's pull it back some. When we... You said 300 meters for you guys. It's 500 meters right. for us. Whenever you're talking about with an M16 or M4, and you're talking about iron sights, and you get on target, if you breathe too deeply and you pull the trigger at the wrong time and it's not a smooth trigger pull, you will 100% miss
Absolutely.
The target.
Absolutely. And
if you just barely pull it just a little bit to the right or left at that distance, you're not hitting it.
It's unbelievable how little error you can have.
You have no at 500 meters on a rifle qualification, you have very, very little room for error. You
right.
know, like as soon as I pull the trigger, based on how my face feels, based on how my body feels with the weapon, based on how my fingers feel, I know for a fact when the target is dropping back down into the pits, what we call it, dropping back down in the pits to get marked, I know if I hit the target or not.
Mm-hmm.
And that's at 500 meters. If I make a tiny little you have to be perfect, man. Like, and like the definition of perfect. There's this form in psychology or in philosophy called the Platonic view of the forms. And Plato says that there is a perfect form of everything. Like, for example, there's a perfect basketball. In this mythical world, there's a perfect form of a basketball where the basketball, the little knobs on the basketball are absolutely perfect.
Mm.
The divots in between the section of the basketball are absolutely perfect. This shot is the Platonic view of the forms for shots for a sniper.
That's a pretty deep way to look at it, but I like it.
I mean, he went damn near 40% further than the record.
Yeah. No, it's unbelievable. I mean, when you try to like start wrapping your brain around it, you gave some perspective. That's like if you're in the Empire State Building and you're sniping me sitting in my apartment in Hoboken.
I've been thinking about this since I wrote the blog. Like I could have gone on forever. Like I've been walking around my apartment. You know, like when you're mad at your significant other and you're like driving and you're thinking about what you can say to them whenever you're done. And then
right.
you've been driving for like 15, 20 minutes and then you're just like... And then, like, that's how I feel
about
this shot.
Yeah.
That I've been thinking about it so much, I'm, like, putting it into perspective for our listeners. And then think about how far it is from the Empire State Building to fucking Hoboken, New Jersey.
Right.
Like, that's a long ways.
Right. No, it's unbelievable. I mean, I tried to figure it out. It's about 35 football fields. So try to wrap your brain around that. I mean, the human eye, unless you're just standing on a flat piece of ground, you can't even see that far.
No, yeah. Like when I watched this show when I was flying sometime with that's called Geniuses, and it had Stephen Hawking on it.
Mm-hmm.
And Stephen Hawking was trying to explain how you could tell the curve of the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And he went like a mile and a quarter or something like that across a lake that was in Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever people were a mile and a quarter across the lake, he had them hold a balloon on the shore.
Sure.
And when they were a mile away, you could no longer see. Even though it appeared to be flat, you could no longer see the balloon because it was so far down, like because
yeah.
the Earth curves at such a rate. I was reading that this shooter, had to aim up because of the gravitational pull of the Earth and the rotational pull of the Earth. He had to aim up 5 football fields. So he had to aim up 500 yards to make it where just gravity would pull it down into the ground.
Yeah, let's not forget about that. Like, you shoot something that far away, like when a bullet leaves a weapon, it doesn't just stay on that plane. Gravity starts, kicks in right away. So to 5 football fields higher, that's ridiculous.
Even at 500 yards, you could see the arc of the bullet. Like, if you're aiming straight, I'm pretty sure it's like 14 feet. If you're shooting flat at 500 meters, it's got to basically be up 14 feet. So if you're standing in the middle and somebody's they're shooting at 500 yards away with iron sights, you could be standing at like 250 yards. They could shoot their target that's in, as a crow flies, it's straight.
Mm-hmm.
But in reality, it's got to curve up over your head. You'd be fine.
Yeah. I've tried to wrap my brain around this shot and I can't do it. I really can't. Because then I start to think from an artillery perspective, when we're shooting that far, the math that is involved in shooting something at that distance and the trajectory and the physics, and for one man to just use a rifle with, you know, I'd imagine some pretty advanced sights. But you know what? People are like, oh, he has sights and da-da-da. You know what? You still got to be so talented.
For 10 seconds, though.
Yeah,
I mean,
still got to be so damn talented.
You can actually see.
Yeah.
But
You got
to
be so talented.
You have to be, like, the human element is perfection, too. Like, you can't just give that to science, you know? The human element of the shooter is still perfect. Mm-hmm. I got it right here. 490 meters at the bullet is going to drop over 10 seconds. 490 meters.
Wow.
That's five football fields. It's going to fall. The bullet is traveling 1,636 miles per hour. Even if you were shooting a 40-mic grenade out of like a 203 or something like that, if you could make a 203 reach out that far like a grenade, you wouldn't be sure in 10 seconds that you would be inside the killer casualty radius at 10 seconds.
No.
I mean, because I could think about just as a casualty stroll, if you didn't know somebody was fucking shooting at you when you're walking down the street, the distance that you're really traveling in 10 seconds, it's pretty far.
Yeah. No, and, you know, we're talking about the human element. Do you think when he hit his target, he just said, sorry?
Yeah, I mean, probably. I don't know what he said. I think that you fucking shit yourself, like, if you do it because you know you're a goddamn legend.
Yeah.
Like, that is legendary shit. That breaking any record by 40% is wild.
Mm-hmm.
Breaking that type of record that's – and people have been snipers for – over 100 years.
Right.
Like, it's not like it's a new thing. Like,
no, and, you know, our weapons have gotten better.
Our technology is better and the round quality and shit like that.
But still.
But still.
I don't know. I'm trying to find more words. And, I just have to, you know, tip your cap and just say, wow, that's very impressive. That is very, very extraordinary.
Appreciate everyone. And so many people have helped me. And that's why I'm sitting here today.
And that was a goal of ours to have this podcast. Because, you know, in years past, former veterans, especially older ones now, they go to, like, the veterans of foreign war, and they hang out with their buddies at places like that, like VFWs, and they go out and drink and stuff. And, like, that doesn't really fit the millennial lifestyle for the most part. So we kind of viewed our podcast as, like, an electronic version of the VFW, where you, like, if you're a veteran and you want to hear some old stories like you used to talk about, tune into our podcast and we'll say stupid shit. So that being said, we're going
to... And so perfect and such a great idea.
So we're going to move into a new segment alert, called Hurry Up and Wait. And no better person to kick this off with, Kyle, an infantry dude who has spent so much time of his career before he became a legend doing Hurry Up and Wait. Like, he was waiting outside for a haircut. He was waiting outside for orders at medical to get a shot that he didn't need, but they told him that he had to have it, and then they forgot that he got it, so he had to go back and get it again. Like, this is Hurry Up and Wait. All right, so the first question in Hurry Up and Wait, Kyle, you know whenever you're doing Hurry Up and Wait that Marines, especially, Army guys too, I'm sure, we talk about the dumbest shit in the world. So we talk about just ridiculous questions. So I'm going to hit you with a question like one of your corporals would have in the past. First question, would you rather have a 2-inch penis or man boobs that lactate all the time?
Oof.
That is a tough one.
You didn't expect these hard-hitting questions.
I did not. And this is harder than college classes. First piece of advice before we kick off, I would say, if you're ever told to, never, ever, ever hurry up and wait on a grenade. As far as hurry up and wait goes, that's probably one don't want to check out of the box.
Wow. But,
the first question, I think I would definitely go with the lactating breasts.
Right.
Because I feel like there is some potential there to have that medically fixed. So
right. That's fair.
That's a sound.
Or if you're out in the field somewhere and you are out of MREs because you already ate all your stuff, you have some sort of nourishment that you can provide to yourself that's better than your own urine.
Yes, this is true.
Or when your supply drop doesn't come, which hypothetically, you know, would never, ever happen.
No, logistically, we're way too good for that to ever happen.
All right, great question. Next.
All right, the next question is, do you think you could paint a wall faster with your face or with your knees?
Well... since I can't really feel about half my face, I don't think it would be I'm not artistic anyway, so I just don't think the face would be the best option. I'd have to go with the painting of the knees.
Okay. What about you?
Oh, but I'm also like 5 foot nothing, so I could probably only paint the bottom half of the film.
Yeah, and I knew that about you because one of the other questions that we were going to have, my friend Kevin, he said, he was like, ask him if he wanted to give up 1 inch of height to gain 1 inch of penis length. And I was like, Kyle's not the tallest dude, so I'm pretty sure I already know the answer there.
Yeah, I gotta keep all I got.
I think you'd stay pat, probably.
5 foot nothing.
What about you? Knees or face?
I gotta go face, just because like I can get my face up and down a wall where it might be harder to get my knees much higher than maybe like waist height. So I think it's got to be my face.
See, the problem with the face is I feel like if you cover your face with so much paint, you're not gonna be able to see. Like, so you're just gonna be running your face into the wall.
That's
I didn't think about that. That's another good point. I'm only rocking 50-50 vision now, so
you should go face and go with the side that your bad eye.
Man.
Yeah, you go like Braveheart. You go like Braveheart, Mel Gibson style.
I'm not going to test this, but I'll go with the photo.
If you decide to, video exclusive rights for Zero Block 30. All right, last question. This is a good one. This is kind of like the thesis of my life. Mm-hmm. Like before I joined Barstool, this was a common thread. You're given the opportunity to gain an extra butthole. You could place it anywhere on your body. Where do you put it and why? See, not stumped that often.
Yeah, absolutely not. I can say 3 times in a row is 3 times more than I've ever been stumped during an interview.
I love how serious he's taking.
Yeah, seriously.
I would say on the bottom of my foot. Okay. So when I'm running very fast and getting shot at the entire time in Afghanistan, mm-hmm. and any bodily events occur, it can just come right on out of the foot and I don't have to worry about it getting on any of my gear, my weapon.
Okay.
That's a very smart answer.
Connor?
I was going to say maybe the palm of my hand. So, you know, if I'm running or if I'm walking and I feel rumbling, I can just like walk over to a trash can and stick my hand over it and then keep moving. Keep it moving.
Now, see, I've done so much thought about this, so my answer is about to blow you guys away, and I'm going to explain first why both of your answers are wrong.
He does so much thought about this.
So, Kyle, your answer is wrong because you know that you're going to have, whenever you're wearing socks and stuff like that, it's going to be rubbing up against it. So you're going to have, like, the worst chafe butt of all time, like if it's on the bottom of your foot.
The Corman has socks on deck.
So you're gonna put moleskin on your foot butt. And yours is wrong because the palm of your hand, you're gonna be shaking people's hand with it.
I'll go lefty, just like
you were so close. You were closer than Kyle. The answer is right here on the wrist, on the bottom part of the wrist. So then to cover it, you have like basically underwear and a wrist guard. So you could just put like a little sweatband on your wrist, and whenever you have like if you're on a long road trip and you have diarrhea or something because you drank too much, you pull that wristband down and just hang it out the window and let it fly.
Yeah. Well, see now, Kyle, the reason Chaps has given so much thought to this.
I was just about to ask that.
Chaps has had violent diarrhea since Easter 2007.
Yeah, with 10-year anniversary this weekend.
Yeah.
Maybe you should go get checked out at Walter Reed.
I did. I had my treatment, too, like because I got shot. And they gave me these pills that was, like, for lead poisoning, so I wouldn't get lead poisoning. And it ripped out the liner of my stomach, and that's what caused it. So I've, like, had diarrhea since forever.
Wait, I'm just going to interject for 1 second, but if you don't mind me asking, that one round they were worried about lead poisoning?
Yep, because the round that they used – they told me, and I never heard this before, they told me that it, like, disintegrated a lot, and they were worried that it got into my bloodstream.
Oh, okay. So, okay. Interesting.
Yeah.
All right, we'll keep it.
I wish they wouldn't have gave it to me. I would have rather had lead poisoning than what I've been dealing with.
Yeah.
Because they're like, sorry, you had an allergic reaction to the medicine. I'm like, I am aware. Like, I've been in this porta potty.
And my butthole is aware, too.
Yeah. I mean, I had this. You
should have given me like 3 months ago, but I appreciate it.
Yeah, because those porta potties in Fallujah weren't the coolest of things in July when I had my arm all wrapped up. It was terrible, man.
Again, I want to thank Kyle for coming on Zero Block 30. Just amazing for me to be able to talk to him. And every time I speak to a warrior like him, or even people that don't have the notoriety, which not many do, of a Kyle Carpenter, I'm always reminded that I'm fortunate to bear the title United States Marine. And this week really hit that point home for me. So, sound the retreat. We'll see you guys next week.